On behalf of the Centre and of the Department of International Relations, welcome to this conference on Arab-Iranian relations. We were very grateful to you all for coming, very pleased to see such a good and such a distinguished audience turning out. Great thanks also to our lineup of speakers and chairs. We're delighted with those who agreed to come today, and we're grateful to them, especially those who travelled from far away to be here today. This conference today is the initiative of Dr. Elizabeth Iskander, who is the VLAM Research Fellow in the International Relations Department. Elizabeth's conference is on this subject, so as part of that, it was her idea to hold this conference today. And we in the Middle East Centre are grateful to her for asking us to get involved and help her organise it and be co-hosts. The proceedings today will be recorded. We do hope there will be a podcast available afterwards, although that's not absolutely certain at the moment. We do know for sure that there will be a report available, because Elizabeth will be writing up the proceedings, and that report will be publicly available later on in the aftermath of the conference. In addition to Elizabeth, I must also thank Dania Akkad and Rebal Sleeman Haider, my colleagues in the Middle East Centre, who did much of the work to enable this conference to happen today. And I'll pass over to our good friend Dr. Hassan Hakimian from LMEI at SOAS. We're very grateful to him for chairing the first session today. And thank you again all for coming.
Thank you very much, Robert. A very warm welcome to all of you today. We have a very interesting day lined up, and that's going to kick off with the first panel. My name is Hassan Hakimian, Director of the London Middle East Institute at SOAS. It gives me great pleasure to chair this first panel on a very important topic. I always think a good academic conference requires a few ingredients. Good room like this one, although the temperature is a little bit high, and I'm sure the intellectual temperature will also rise during the day. We'll try and keep things civil and productive, of course, no doubt. We need a good panel, and on this occasion we are spoiled for choice. An excellent topic, a topic which has deep roots in the history and culture of both Iranians and Arabs, and which will no doubt, which has a lot of resonance with what's going on recently, of course, and also will continue to exercise us, I'm sure, for years to come. We also need a chair who will make himself or herself as invisible as possible. I'll do my best, except when it comes to time management, because we have a lot to cover, and that requires a little bit of timekeeping. So you've been warned. The last but not least ingredient is an excellent audience, and this is never a problem at LSE. I say that because I'm an alumnus of LSE. Okay, without further ado, our panelists are well known to most of you. I'm not going to spend much time holding things up further. We are starting a good 10 minutes late. I think we will squeeze the tea coffee break by 10 minutes, and we'll try and finish at 10 past 11. Each speaker will have 15 minutes, followed by the other speaker, and we will save questions and answers and discussion to the end of the presentations. And I hope we will have a very interactive session in that respect. We will proceed with speakers. Ali Ansari, Professor Ali Ansari from St. Andrews, well-known specialist on Iran, and in fact in his talk he will be mainly focusing on the Iran side of issues. We will then go on to hear David Butter, although he's listed third on the program, and he will be mainly addressing the Arab side of issues. And last but not least, Dr. Katrina Dalakura from LSE, who will be talking about Iran, the Arabs, and a little bit of Turkey, all in 15 minutes. Okay, well, without further ado, if I can ask our first speaker to start. I know this room is a bunker, and I checked, my mobile is off. Please make sure that yours is as well. And without further ado, Ali, over to you, please.
Thank you very much, Hassan. It's a very great pleasure to be here. Thank you to Bob for inviting me. It's good to see so many friends, some of whom I haven't seen in years, literally, but good to see you here. I have 15 minutes. Unfortunately, there isn't a clock to... Oh, there is, behind me. There you are. So I can keep an eye on the time, but I'm sure Hassan is going to cut me off as soon as I approach that time. So I'm going to only highlight a few major points. There's a bit of entertainment on the wall for you if you get bored of what I'm saying. It's really to clarify or visualise the theme of nationalism that I'm going to be talking about, because of course the understanding of Iran-Arab relations, particularly after 2003 and particularly after the launch of the global war on terror, cannot be understood really outside the context of nationalist discourse, which has basically shaped and dominated in many ways Iranian political life, even under Mr. Ahmadinejad, as we'll see. There's a couple of nice juicy pictures of him with Cyrus the Great coming up. but also from the Arab side. I know others will talk about the Arab side more, but we've got to bear in mind that some of these, the ways in which they identify the other is two-way, and that in some ways what you're seeing in the Islamic Republic is an attempt to square the circle. They want, on the one hand, to promote a certain sort of Islamic foreign policy, but actually in practice, for much of the existence of the Islamic Republic, they've been pulled in one way or another towards a much more local, what we may term a nationalist agenda. And that nationalist agenda, what I'm trying to say, is not really defined against the West. I think there are sort of notions that people, generally in popular discourse, will argue that it's defined against the sort of the West, particularly Britain in some ways, and also obviously the United States. But actually much more at heart, much more to the core of this, is that sort of dichotomy between the Persians and the Arabs, if I can use that rather old-fangled term. Now, obviously there's been a period of, because of the 15 minutes, I'm not going to go way into historical context here for you, so you're probably relieved, but obviously the rise of Iranian nationalism as a political tool in the 20th century, in many ways, certainly under the Pahlavis, was defined against the sort of a traditional conception of the Arabs. The Islamic Revolution, of course, altered that dynamic. It altered that dynamic because of the dominance or the attempted dominance of an Islamic narrative within that discourse. But very soon, that was diluted by the experience of the Iran-Iraq War. So almost immediately, you have this attempt, officially, in the government. I'm sort of slightly moving because I think I'm being blinded by this screen. So I'll move over here. Maybe I should move to the middle. That might be better, but it seems to be like a halo of light, which might get me to say things that I don't want to say. The attempt to build a sort of a much more universalistic, I suppose even a third world narrative, but basically an Islamic narrative, was essentially contradicted by the Iran-Iraq War. The way in which, of course, Khomeini tried to do this was to define things in terms of American Islam and real Islam. In this way, automatically, you begin to see that what Iran was identifying itself with was the true Islam. So you begin to get, very quickly, from a move which is rather more sort of pan-Islamic, at least in its orientation, becomes actually Iranian-Islamic. And that process of Iranianization of that Islamic narrative carries on in the post-war period. And really, between Iran and the Arab world, in the period of Rafsanjani and Khatami, we can describe that, in retrospect certainly, and all history is contemporary history from one perspective, as a period of détente. And certainly under Khatami, you had a period of détente between Iran and the Arab world. And one of the things we have to bear in mind, by the way, I'm going to emphasise some of the distinctions and differences, but we must also not forget the tremendous sort of cultural and economic contact, certainly between Iran and the Persian Gulf region. So those continue. I mean, there are many layers of this relationship. But certainly in the realms of official discourse, there was an attempt, certainly from 1997 onwards, to start to bridge those gaps, to start to, when we remember Khatami, I think, you know, the halcyon days, off he was to Damascus, off he was to Beirut, and, you know, here was an Iranian leader who could speak Arabic, you know, who was talking in very classical Arabic as it may be, but nonetheless, many of the Arabs were oppressed, and if you saw it in the reverse, I mean, this is one of the things the Iranians get very irritated about, not unjustifiably, is that you could probably find relatively few Arab leaders who could speak Persian in reverse. Nonetheless, the whole narrative is shaken by 2001, and certainly the global war on terror and the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. And one of the arguments I've been trying to put forward, and it will be, I'm going to plug my book here, because it's going to come out soon, hopefully, CEP permitting, but one of the arguments that I'm trying to articulate, I suppose, there, is the way in which the global war on terror, the sort of the shattering of the regional dynamics, particularly in Afghanistan and Iraq, the breaking down of the old order in some ways, allowed Iranians to realise a different conception of their national idea. It was one that, in many ways, was not limited by the frontiers that had been given to them, say, in the post-First World War period. Now, what that means is, of course, there's a much more fluid, in some ways, it becomes more realistic. You know, this artificial divide between Arab and Iranian suddenly becomes shattered, particularly in Iraq. and the Iranians become much, much more influential and much more heavily involved in developments in Iran. Some of these are obviously reasons of geopolitics, some of these are reasons of economic aggrandizement, some of these are actually reasons that are slightly more surreal and are to do with a concept of a national idea, which is Iraq as generally, as I know Kamal's going to get very annoyed at me here, but as Iraq is generally part of Iran's near abroad, if I can put it that way. Okay, so you get this element. Now, just at this moment when this thing happens, almost on the cusp, you get a wonderful populist leader by the name of Mr. Ahmadinejad, who really exploits this international arena, this international sort of opportunity, so to speak. And one of the things we have to bear in mind about Mr. Ahmadinejad is that for all the millenarian rhetoric, he has been, it's not a paradox per se, but certainly it's interesting because we tend to negate this, he has been in many ways the most nationalistic president of Iran since the revolution. Now, I don't mean that term in terms of that he maybe has an understanding of what the nationalist agenda is or priorities is, but he has used the motifs of nationalism in an almost shameless way. I mean, it's been extraordinary. I mean, really, and I do feel that the last Shah would be turning in his grave or blushing red or whatever. I mean, if you think what's happened, Rafsanjani had visited Persepolis in 1991 but had to make the required sort of like apologies for having done so. Here we see that in 1997 Ahmadinejad is actually shameless about using these sort of pre-Islamic motifs to emphasise what he considers to be this sort of national agenda within his view of Iran and also Iran's foreign policy. Now this obviously puts him at odds in many ways with the Arab world. And what's interesting, I suppose, about him is that in his approach he's tried to justify both. On the one hand, he tries to sort of argue that we are all part of one Islamic brotherhood and one Islamic community, although recently he stopped using the word Ummah necessarily. He talks about a lot more about the Millat in Iran and other things. At the same time, what he's really trying to, and maybe he's just being explicit about what many other Iranian leaders have been implicit about, and that is basically to say, yes, you know, we are all part of one big happy Islamic community, but, you know, we're on top. Okay, so, you know, don't forget it, you know, partly because we've been here longer than anyone else, we're more powerful, blah, blah, blah. Now, this is the sort of thing that he wants to emphasise. There have been arguments, of course, more popular in the United States about this division between the Shia and Sunni, this sort of sectarian argument. I think that's an argument that's probably emanated more from the Arab side than it has from the Iranian side. The Iranians certainly don't want to exacerbate the Shia-Sunni. It's a good thing I've said everything controversial before Dr. Dodge came in, because now we're going to have to behave. From the other side, of course, and this is something also we need to bear in mind, that for all the nationalism coming out of Iran and the nationalist rhetoric, of course there's been an equivalent sort of move from the Arab side. And one of the things that struck me really in the post, I suppose really what came out after Saddam Hussein's execution in 2006, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was then, there was a flurry of activity in the press on both sides. The Iranians, of course, were not really shedding any tears over Saddam Hussein's execution. They saw him really as a tyrant who had to go. The Arabs on the other side saw this really either as part of a Shia sort of dominated conspiracy, but also what was probably more interesting was the use of the term Safavid. So what they saw in Shiism was actually something that was intrinsically Iranian. Okay, so they identified the Iranians, they identified Shiism with something that was distinctly sort of local and national. So when Hezbollah would talk about, you know, in its wars with Israel and its conflict with Israel, basically a lot of the Arab states would talk of Hezbollah as really being an extension of the Safavids. In this way, it was a sense of localising it and nationalising it. Now, I'll just do the other slide. Next slide. Where's the next slide? How do I do it? There we are. Iran has made a big deal, obviously, of trying to exploit nationalist sentiment, particularly when it comes to the Persian Gulf. Many of you will be familiar with this banknote, but remember the Persian Gulf is always in nice, bold Latin letters, just to let everyone know. That's what they're emphasising. Also, when they come to various disputes that they've had, particularly in the Gulf countries and the UAE, there's always been these islands, although that's softened of late. It hasn't really come up too much in the rhetoric. Nonetheless, it's been something that they felt they can exploit, sort of nationalist mood in Iran. There's nothing to excite Iranians more than nationalism, it has to be said. I mean, if religion is the opium of the masses, nationalism is an altogether more stimulating drug, and it's used on quite a regular basis. Whether people actually sincerely believe some of the stuff that they're shouting and screaming, and this is basically rent a crowd, but it's always quite interesting. I mean, this sort of idea that we should send troops into the islands. The other area, of course, that has been a sore point has been Bahrain. I'm not going to wait before the Arab Spring, but even before the Arab Spring, you've had comments, even coming out of hardline press in Iran, Tehran newspaper, not London, Tehran, basically also made the point that, you know, Bahrain really should return to the motherland. They did it in sectarian terms, but clearly there was a nationalist agenda there that they were talking about. Now, probably the most interesting thing has been Ahmadinejad's use of, as I said, the pre-Islamic motifs, but even more striking, the motifs of Cyrus, which is probably the most remarkable thing. There we are. Now, there is someone dressed up. Now, this is a wonderful, I mean, this sort of image sums up the contradictions rather well. There's Cyrus being made a member of the Basij. Because, and if you look at the kafir, you know, the sort of Palestinian, the sort of, I mean, it's an Iranian version of it. But this is a fascinating sort of reconciliation of something that clearly obviously doesn't work, both chronologically and in many other ways. I mean, the article that accompanied this was full of sort of triumphalist gusto, but it's this idea that Cyrus the Great is actually has been brought into a broader narrative, almost a broader Islamic narrative. Although they stop, I mean, it's a way to legitimise him doing it. But the speech Ahmadinejad gave on the occasion when the British Museum lent the Cyrus cylinder back to Iran is far in excess of anything that the Shah said in 71, by the way. It's quite extraordinary in terms of human rights and freedom, and also what he said that Cyrus did for the region. And one of the things interesting about the region, and I'm going to end on this Cyrus cylinder, because it's quite interesting to see their conception of the world around them and also their conception of the outer world. If you notice, when the Cyrus cylinder was going back, they said, well, this was in Iran, and the British stole it, and we want it back. And there was a lot of this rhetoric, and of course the British Museum got very touched about it, but understandably. Of course, the response here was, no, it was found in Iraq in 1879, which was not in Iran, it was actually Babylonia. Of course, the answer to this from the Iranians is, but that was part of Iran. You know, this is part of Iran, I mean, what are you talking about? And their conception of that is basically a conception of an Iranian state, which, as I always say, is the Euphrates, the Oxus, the Indus, and the Caucasus. And you'll notice there that a lot of the current Arab world probably occupy that area, as well as a few Turks now and then. But it's a sort of a vision of Iran, which is what we may call Greater Iran. I mean, the term is Iran Shah in traditional history. And this is, you know, because another one that really gave the game away was Mashhad. Mashhad made a wonderful point, because there was this big debate about the Iranian school and the Arab school and the Islamic school. And Mashhad said that there was some controversy apparently, because Mashhad said that the Prophet was Iranian. I mean, that's a wonderful bit of nationalising Islam. But and obviously they criticised him, and they said, what is this nonsense at all? That? He said, I never said that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was an Iranian. I said Abraham was an Iranian. Now, that actually makes things worse, I mean, if you think about it, but it's quite interesting why he should come to that conclusion. Because the biblical Abraham comes from Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is part of Iraq. Now, that's part of their worldview. And you have to sort of, when you're looking at Iran-Arab relations in this post-global war on terror, you have to understand that national discourse in Iran and what they're looking at and how they're envisaging Iran at this period. It's a very old school view, by the way. It's almost a pre-Pahlavi view. Okay, I mean, bear that in mind, and it's much more in some ways than it three. So, now the Arab Spring, because that's obviously the important one. How do they deal with the Arab Spring? I'm going to let other, I mean, plenty of others will talk about this, but I'm a historian, I don't deal with modern stuff. Obviously, the Arab Spring has been a major contradiction for them on many different levels. And you can basically split it into three, basically, how they deal with it. One is obviously Tunisia and Egypt, which is a positive development for them, of course, because, you know, here you're throwing out Western-backed dictators, and it's really reliving the, you know, as the government sort of said, this is the Islamic Revolution a little bit late. What's interesting, actually, about the view is both sides in Iran, opposition and government, basically say, we took the lead, by the way, the Arabs a bit late, but nonetheless, thank God they're following us. So the government basically says, these are Islamic revolutions, a bit belated, but thank God you've got there. The opposition in Iran say, no, this Arab Spring came after a Persian summer. So, you know, we were the precursors of all this. We didn't do very well, but compared to them, we're a bit jealous. But nonetheless, you know, it started all here. From the government point of view, of course, their original arguments about this being a positive thing have sunk rather below the radar, particularly because of Libya and Syria. And the one point I would draw attention to is Bahrain. It's very interesting that in Bahrain they have not done anything really to try and provoke the situation in Bahrain. And that for me tells me two things really. One is that, well, one actually is a major thing, and that is that they're too preoccupied with their own problems at home. It would be very easy for them to stir the pot by sending a flotilla of aid, which could be returned back a la Gaza, you know, from Bahrain, and that creates a huge deal. But they haven't done anything. In fact, the rhetoric has even gone quiet, other than on blogs. So the government itself is finding, in my view, the whole issue of the Arab Spring somewhat problematic. It's difficult to sell, certainly on the official narrative. And of course, with the mass media that you have, people are aware of what's going on. My sense is that in the long term, medium to long term, Iranians will look with a considerable amount of envy at what's going on in Syria and Libya in particular, probably more envy of Tunisia and Egypt, but I can't see Iran going away of Tunisia and Egypt. But Libya and Syria are points of note for both sides of the argument in Iran. And it's something that, in terms of copycat, we probably ought to be aware of. Thank you very much. I think that's
great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ali, for that very interesting and well time-managed presentation. Our next speaker is David Butter, who is the director of the Middle East and North Africa program at the Economist Intelligence Unit. So I hand it over to you, please.
Thank you. I'll probably pick up a lot of the themes that Ali's introduced, very much the nationalism, it's part of it. Looking at it more from the perspective on the Arab side, say, of a consumer of Iranian nationalism, if you like. It was interesting what he said about Greater Iran in context of some remarks by the Iranian defense minister a couple of days ago, when he said that thanks to the wonders of Iranian technology, their mapping technology had established that Iran, rather than being 1.64 million square kilometers, is actually 1.88 million square kilometers. That's added a region which, by our calculation, is about the size of Utah, or the size of 30 Bahrains or 20 Lebanons. Not quite clear where all this stuff is, but I suspect that some of it may possibly be in Mesopotamia, I'm not sure, but interesting, and I think that the Arab press, Sheikh Al-Awsat, for example, picked up on this as being an interesting addition, and it's obviously much bigger than just the islands and the Gulf. Certainly that nationalism, that sense of the Islamic revolution as being a great expression of anti-Western, the proper way to go about it, something that the uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia have come to lately, is very much part of the whole theme of Iran's interaction with the Arab world over a long time. There's also been an element of self-defense. Clearly, when the Islamic Revolution started, it came under attack very early on from the Arab world, with the Iraqi invasion, which I think it's clear did have some sort of collusion, certainly some support from the Gulf Arabs. And I think a lot of the themes that have developed in Iran have arisen from that, including the nuclear program. I think it's clear from the Iranians that although the Iranians have this sort of personal sense of superiority, they do look on the Gulf Arabs as having a sense of inferiority. It's a relationship that Iran periodically tries to cultivate. They try to establish some ground rules, but I think there are some clear underlying tensions in that relationship. Another element of this Iranian superiority complex is that there is a little contradiction there, that in some areas there's an envy of what the Gulf Arabs certainly have achieved in areas of economy, and there's the opportunity costs of Iran's posture towards the outside world, which has been in rather below potential growth, and the examples of Dubai's rise, and fall, but still the successes such as they are in the Gulf in Saudi Arabia, Qatar on the North Field and its exportation of its part of the common field with Iran to become the largest LNG supplier in the world. I think these are issues of concern for Iran, as is the prospect that within 2 or 3 years Iraq may well end up producing more oil than Iran. And finally, I'll talk a little bit about the Arab uprisings, revolutions, whatever you like to call it, and what the awkward messages this has for Iran's sense of power projection. But I think it's certainly important that for the sustaining the momentum and the identity and the relevance of the Islamic Revolution, being involved and actively involved in parts of the Arab world is essential to fostering and renewing and validating that that sense of Iranian nationalism. Now, we've seen perhaps the most successful instance of Iran's power projection in Lebanon. And I think there's an interesting aspect to that which has relevance possibly to Bahrain as well, in that there were different approaches in Lebanon to how much they were going to buy into the Islamic Revolution at a very early stage. Lebanese clerics, Shia clerics, always had a very strong Iranian connection, and it will be fascinating to see if out of the ruins of Libya we learn anything more about Musa Sadr, who was very much engaged and involved in the early planning, if you like, of the Iranian Revolution, was very much associated with Muntasiri Shamran Ali Shariati trend, and was heartily detested by Khomeini. And that was, a lot of it was to do with the sense of the Velayat al-Faqih, whether that is something that's appropriate to have in Arab Shia context, or whether the relation, if you like, between the clerics and the state should be different, with less explicit powers vested in the clerical leadership. And that issue continues to be relevant, and I think is still relevant in Bahrain, certainly, where there's some kickback against the sense of the Wilayat al-Faqih. I don't want to go back too far, but clearly the Israeli invasion in 1982 did provide Iran with a perfect opportunity to strengthen its position in Lebanon, the deployment of multinational forces, the development of Hezbollah, development of military commanders such as Imad Magniyeh and Adnan Badruddin, who's since come to light as being indicted for the Hariri assassination. This was very much an opportunity that Iran took full advantage of. And you can say that now Lebanon is fairly strongly in the Iranian orbit, but the difficulty now is Iran has to negotiate its way around the possibility that the Assad regime may go down, and how it will then preserve the imperative strategic presence it has in Lebanon if things do change that way in Syria. Just a brief note on 2006. I think possibly it worked in two ways. In one way, it did show that Hezbollah and Iran were much more formidable adversaries for Israel than they'd assumed earlier, but I think possibly this wasn't ideal from Iran's point of view, in that it did rather show their hand. But of course, in the meantime, the capabilities of Hezbollah militarily in Lebanon have been improved. Now, we didn't really mention the nuclear factor here, and I'm not going to go on to it too far, but my understanding is that there was originally very much a self-defensive aspect to Iran's huge investment in trying to develop the capability to produce ultimately nuclear weapons if they at one point chose to do that through a wholly indigenous process. This probably was part of a nationalistic agenda, perhaps going back to the Shah, but I think that certainly from Iran's point of view, when it became clear to them both that Saddam Hussein was trying to develop nuclear weapons in the 80s, and that after the war with Iran finished in 1988, that he was determined to go on with this program. It made sense from Iran's point of view to take some countermeasures, and my understanding of this, I don't think anybody really knows all the ins and outs of it, is that probably this program acquired a momentum of its own which was very difficult to stop. Perhaps we had a moment around 2003 when it came out. You had the Hassan Rouhani, the interaction with the group of three, that perhaps Iran was putting out the possibility of getting off this branch. But I think it was too difficult an issue for Iran explicitly, or anybody in the Iranian political establishment, to explicitly clamp down off. And since then, I think, you know, matters have moved on. The Gulf Arabs are living with the reality that probably Iran in the next 5 to 10 years will become a nuclear capable power. Now, how do they deal with that? Well, on the one hand, they can take a pragmatic view in saying that there are huge opportunity costs to Iran for persisting with this program, and ultimately weaken Iran, and that nuclear weapons anyway are not particularly effective in political brinkmanship, because ultimately you can't really use them. The other thing, the Arabs, of course, there are people who advocate this, is they try and match like for like. My view is they probably won't. There's too many costs associated with that, and they probably don't have the capability to catch up. Now, a few words about Iraq. I kind of titled this sort of proto PowerPoint slide as "At least Iraq belongs to us." In the context of things perhaps slipping away from Iran elsewhere in the Arab world, they can look on Iraq as pretty well in their orbit. Clearly, the US invasion, its aftermath, was beneficial to Iran, the shift from a benign but hostile regime to one that's more closely aligned with them. They took a dual or multi-track approach to dealing with the Iraqi reality, supporting several different Shia parties in government, as well as providing logistics, training, funding to militant and armed groups. The initial main Iranian vehicle in Iraq, the Supreme Islamic Iraqi Council, that lost out politically over time, but Iran did hedge its bets through supporting other groups, and it's brought in most of the Shia parties. It's got lines in to most of the actors in the Shia firmament. The difficulty as far as the Arab reaction to Iran's involvement in Iraq is that I think quite often it's portrayed in a very crude and mechanistic way, particularly by some Saudi commentators, as being that the Maliki government is just a pawn of Iran. I don't think it quite works like that. Iran certainly has a lot of influence in Iraq, but it's also aware that it can't display this too nakedly, because there will always be an Iraqi nationalist or Arab nationalist pushback. There is the other problem as far as Iran is concerned in Iraq, is that they do have the Najaf, the importance of Najaf as a source of Shia orthodoxy, or a Shia approach to politics, which is rivals to Qom, is a rival also to the Wilayat al-Faqih. The other thing ultimately, which I referred to before, is that Iraq does have the potential ultimately to become quite a heavy hitter economically, thanks to its underexploited oil reserves. So Iraq could be producing 6 or 7 million barrels a day of oil in the next 5 to 10 years, and whether Iran will be able to come anywhere near that, or actually Iran's oil might decline, is another issue. Briefly on the Arab revolutions, as Ali said, the overthrow of the Western dictators was a good thing for Iran, but not really that much thanks to Iran, however much the Islamic Republic has tried to appropriate them, but in not a very credible way. Iran does have a potentially promising situation in Egypt and Gaza, but my view is that the Egyptians, even the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, are not really keen to play an Iranian game here. And I think that Iran works more through Islamic Jihad, will heat up the situation on the Gaza-Egypt front, but Hamas is not keen to see this happen, and I don't think the Egyptians, at any point, any part of the Egyptian spectrum, is also interested in being pulled into a kind of proxy confrontation which is being manipulated by Iran in this area. In Bahrain, I think the Iranians appreciate, I think, as I was saying, that Saudi Arabia has drawn a red line in Bahrain. I don't think Iran sees Bahrain as worth Iran getting into a serious fight with Saudi Arabia. And I think they also appreciate that their influence over the Shia is not as strong as perhaps that is of the other source of authority in Najaf. Syria. I don't think it's a zero-sum game for Iran. If Assad goes down, Iran goes down with it. The relationship or the strategic alliance between Iran and Syria has always been fairly opportunistic. I think the Iranians have not necessarily always trusted the motives of the Syrians. Syrians have gained in pecuniary terms from it. Iran has gained in strategic terms through being able to develop Hezbollah as its own proxy force in the region, as well as perhaps the military wings of Hamas and Islamic Jihad. I think from Iran's point of view, Bashar al-Assad is probably expendable, but Iran would certainly like to preserve its lines into the Syrian military and security establishment. I think Iran would be only seriously worried in Syria if there was a sort of Salafist-type takeover or an extremely pro-Western takeover in Syria. People come into power in Syria whose first inclination would be to resolve the Arab-Israeli dispute and go into the Western orbit. I don't think either of those outcomes are very likely because of the diversity and disparate forces that are going to be involved. Supply lines to Hezbollah, well, the Suez Canal now is open. Lebanon is pretty well under control of Hezbollah, and Turkey is probably another option. Interesting, the developments in Turkish-Israeli relations, how that might affect Iran, as we'll perhaps discuss later on. Finally, the Gulf Arabs. In a sense, I've put down a heading here: unworthy adversaries. Certainly there is this sense of looking down on them, but there perhaps is a sting in the tail from the Gulf Arab side. You do have commentators in the Gulf. You go from Nawaf Obeid and Prince Turki in Saudi Arabia, the UAE Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed, and perhaps even Mohammed bin Zayed, the Crown Prince of the UAE in Abu Dhabi. They're sort of the more hysterical end of the anti-Iran spectrum in the Gulf. But I don't think there's anybody seriously going to depart from a kind of pragmatic line towards Iran, especially in the knowledge that the US is retreating, in a sense, in terms of supporting any kind of Gulf Arab action. So finally, I'd say the strongest weapon on the Gulf Arab side is the success of their own economic model. Iran can tap into that to some extent through using Dubai. If the Saudi, UAE, Qatar, even Iraq are going to be going forward with average growth rates of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%, and Iran is going to be languishing at about 2 or 3%, over time this does provide an ongoing indictment against the whole Islamic Republic project, which make it increasingly difficult for Iran's nationalistic claims to stand up when it faces its own people.